The views of this program are not necessarily the views of KJLL Radio, its management, or its sponsors. The host is solely responsible for its content. Enjoy.
On a mission given to me by Woody Shaw, Sonship, Dizzy, and Billy Higgins, dedicated to pursuing a piece of our cultural heritage through interviews with my jazz heroes, this is the Jake Feinberg Show. Welcome, everybody, to the Jake Feinberg Show. And it's truly nice weather for ducks. Just a couple of statements here at the opening. November 6th, Sunday, November 6th, come check out the Tucson Record Show. And if you have any antique or components, record players, and devices, go to the Stereo Hospital and get them checked out. It's a reasonable rate to preserve these types of antiques. So in any event, my guest today on the Jake Feinberg Show is one of the most prolific songwriters, arrangers, and players, pianists, in modern jazz history. He came here from Auckland, New Zealand, and attended the Berklee School of Music in Boston. He had a steady run of playing, composing, and arranging for the Woody Herman big bands in the late 60s and early 70s. I became first introduced to this man because of his accompanist work alongside the late great singer Irene Kroll. He epitomizes the cool Southern California cadre of musicians that were and are still prevalent today. He is also author and performer of many of his own albums as a leader, and continues playing today with, among other groups, the Charlie Hayden Quartet West with Ernest Watts. Alan Broadbent, welcome to the Jake Feinberg Show.
Oh, thank you so much, Jake. Glad to be here. Well, there.
You are in both places, my friend. It's great. It's so great to talk to you, man. I wanted to ask you, growing up in Auckland, can you talk about the philosophy of New Zealanders when it came to supporting the arts?
Wow. At that time, I was, just basically isolated or insulated. I was studying with the nuns from the time I was 6 till about 12. But it was in that very closed environment. My parents really weren't interested in the arts at all. It just wasn't part of their lifestyle at all. So I was kind of discovering things for myself. I'd never heard a symphony orchestra or jazz, for that matter. And I started discovering things at the Onehunga Library. Onehunga is a Maori word, and it's a suburb of Auckland. And so I'd go down there, and at the age of 12, 13, when I was trying to figure out what music was all about, I was borrowing records of Nelson Riddle and Frank Sinatra because I knew these songs from my dad's sheet music. My dad played a little bit of piano and some banjo, and but he had a stack of sheet music from what was the when the Americans came down during the war at that and. So I would go through these stacks, and I just knew intuitively, hey, that's a beautiful melody or something. Well, I didn't know anything about the harmonies. I'd just read the sheet music harmony. And then a friend of mine, his brother was a bassoonist with the New Zealand Symphony. And I had never really been to any symphonic concert, but his brother had 2 tickets to see Dave Brubeck, and this would have been 1961 when I was 3 years old. No. But anyway,
who was in Brubeck's band at that time when you saw them?
It was the classic band. It was
the Jader Garaldi band.
No, this was Paul Desmond, Gene Wright, and Joe Morello.
Oh, Joe Morello. Okay.
Yes, they were on their first world tour, out of which Time Out further out had Maori blues on it.
I got you.
But I hadn't really even heard that music because this was just at the time that Time Out was about to be released. And, I remember vividly that Paul came out with the quartet, and he sort of leaned himself against the bell of the piano, and they began the first phrase of Tangerine. And I knew this song already, but I could not believe that you could do that with music. Paul singing the line and Dave punching those beautiful comping chords and that he used to do, and the steady time of it. I was thrilled with every note, and changed my life. And from then on, I knew that music had all kinds of possibilities for me.
Yeah, it was not something that was linear. It was something that really could be experimented with and tinkered with and turned into something...
your own.
Exactly. And I mean, I think that and it speaks to jazz primarily. And I asked the original question. I just wanted to know, you know, to put a cap on it, as far as, you know, was it possible to pursue a degree in music in Auckland when you were growing up? Was that considered a lifestyle? Could that be
no.
a lifestyle?
No, unless you were going to be a symphonic player or something.
So it was only classical?
Yes, it was only classical. But I had to seek out musicians to find and learn how to do it, because jazz, real jazz, swinging, Louis Armstrong all the way through Bird jazz, is a hand-me-down art.
Mm-hmm.
Learn it from the older guys, how to get that feeling and everything, and that's what I had to consciously seek out.
Aside from Brubeck Desmond, which was clearly a catharsis in your life, were you exposed to sort of some of the older cats? Would some of them come to New Zealand? Did you get a chance to see them at clubs?
What I did when I was 14 was I answered an ad in the paper. Some guys were looking for a piano player for a little jazz group, and they were a couple of years older than me, but they didn't know what they were doing either. So we all would just get God knows what it sounded like, but we would all together and play what we thought was jazz. And then I got a serious call from one of the cats in Auckland, and they had coffee houses. There were no bars or anything, but the coffee houses, there was one called the Montmartre in Auckland, where the heavy guys, their name's Mike Walker. Oh, my memory, but anyway, they had that feeling, and Tony Hopkins was the drummer that played in this trio, and he was the one that called me to play a gig, and I was 16 at the time, and I was totally into Dave Brubeck, Time Out, and I used to wear a trench coat to my gigs or whatever I had, you know.
I love it. That's great, though. I mean, you were totally in it.
My mom and dad, they didn't know what the hell was going on. Puberty and jazz at the same time.
Dude, you were exploding in all areas.
Whoa. Look out.
You know, I wanted to say, when I talked to Ernie Watts, he mentioned that he won a downbeat scholarship to get into the Berklee School of Music.
Mm-hmm.
I think that your story, I'd like you to explain how you wound up there. I think it's one of the more fascinating stories in music history.
Oh, I'm glad you think I'm a part of it. But what happened was when I'd been playing with Tony, and he taught me basically how to get that feeling, because it was not happening. I was, you know, just, how do you explain that feeling? That stretching of the time and leaning back and swinging. I didn't know how to swing.
Mm-hmm.
So I was starting to get that together, and I decided at the age of 18 to submit what I made an acetate at that time. I couldn't afford a tape recorder, but I had a friend who could record, and I went in and did a little duo with him on Speak Low. I still remember the song. And I sent that from New Zealand to Berkeley, and lo and behold, I got a one-semester scholarship for like $250 or something, at which point I quit my sign writing job. I was apprenticing as a sign writer, which I can still do if anybody needs.
You need some
writing,
like yield for construction guys, that kind of stuff.
No, it was more show card writing
for
department stores and stuff. You know, 50% off, and my favorite part was putting snow on the lettering at Christmas time, even though I'd never seen snow or anything.
Just got to do it. Yeah, no.
Creative, you know.
Got to do it.
So I quit that job, and so I could do evening gigs and make some money, I took an afternoon job with the Auckland Star, which was a newspaper. And when I think about it now, it just terrifies me, because I'd have to stick my hand into every 25 newspapers coming off the conveyor belt. Had one that was poking out, and you'd slip your hand in there without gloves or anything and pull it out from the conveyor belt and put it onto another conveyor belt, stacking them, as you know, like four at a time as it went by. And it was all a question of timing. When that horn went off, you know, the conveyor belts were coming nonstop for at least an hour. I'd come home with like ink up my nose, and I don't know what it's done to me now.
Well, it's probably, I'm just glad it didn't damage any of your digits.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that could have been perilous.
Yeah, well, I survived that, but it enabled me to work gigs at night to save up enough money. And I, at that time, flying to America was a big problem. Biggest problem was I couldn't afford it.
Right.
But it hopped, skipped, and jumped over the islands, up Norfolk and to Hawaii, blah, blah, blah. So I actually took a boat from Wellington. My parents saw that this was something that I needed to do, and whatever else, they at least had the wisdom to let me go. And I took a boat for 32 days, all the way up to through Tahiti, L.A., down through the Panama Canal, Jamaica, up to New York.
Unbelievable. I mean, that in itself is a trip. I mean, that's really a trip.
Yeah, well, I was pretty determined, you know. I was pretty determined to do it.
When you got to Boston, it's a place that I spent many years of my life, and in the 90s. So, I mean, a lot of the classic clubs were gone at that point.
Yeah.
But were you part of the? Were you able to get involved with the Jazz Workshop? When you were there, maybe they'd bring... I know I spoke to Larry Taylor, who ran Paul's Mall and the Jazz Workshop. And he talked about doing something where sometimes a major head, a heavy guy would come in, Sonny Rollins or, you know, whoever else,
yeah.
and they would surround him with cats that were playing at Berkeley. Did you have that kind of experience when you were there?
I had one experience. Just let me tell you that when I was going to school... Herb Pomeroy, on that first summer break, you know, I didn't have a gig. I was running out of money, so Herb recommended me to play a cocktail lounge called My Apartment Lounge.
Cool.
In the Hotel Vendome, which I believe burned down in the 90s, very tragically, because I noticed there's a monument to the firemen there that lost their lives. But anyway, this was in the basement. And from solo piano, I got to have a trio. But this whole hotel was one alleyway away from the Jazz Workshop. And the Jazz Workshop was a place where, unfortunately, there's nothing like it now that I know of, where for $2, students could sit in the back and mind their own business and hear the greatest jazz. I mean, within 2-3 weeks of being in Boston, I was hearing Miles Davis, I heard Bill Evans, Lee Konitz, Cannonball Adderley, they were all there every week. But I was working I would go during my breaks. I would go next door, and the one person I remember I did get a gig at Paul's Mall, which was the adjacent club to Jazz Workshop, was Anita O'Day.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, oh, it terrified me. She was sweet. You know, I'd play a wrong intro or something, and she'd just look at me, because, you know, I was just a kid, and she'd say, oh, well, that's where you want to go. Okay, darling.
You know, Alan, I'll tell you, I mean, and I just see it with my friends. I see it in life in general. We've become a society obsessed with perfection.
Yeah.
Instead of allowing really just sort of the beauty to flow and the acceptance, okay, it, you know, maybe he flubbed the intro. Who cares? Let's do it, and let's be accepting, and let's turn it into something.
We'll make something of it, yeah.
Especially in a live context.
She was gracious like that. And again, it's a hand-me-down thing. It's like she was teaching me by singing and just showing me how to comp with her phrasing and stuff, you know. And it was, of course, we didn't have YouTube then, and now you see everybody in their glory and in their fantastic talent. But then it was just me struggling with this woman who was a great singer. I knew about her reputation, but my God, the greatness of these people, you know. And now you can see it. Everybody can see it. You know, we had this saving, you know, up to buy unknown LPs of some artist like anybody.
Right.
But you know, just to have that one solo or something, it was precious. And of course, everything is available now.
Well, everything's available, but yet it's not available. In the sense that some stuff has been, you know, you have iTunes now, but I don't think there's a copy of Crawl Space on iTunes.
And that's kind of an underground thing.
But that's what I'm saying is the appreciation, and yeah. I don't want to get into it right now because, quite frankly, I want to spend a lot of time on that particular era, because in many ways it was something that helped form my appreciation for vocal jazz, which was the whole idea of Catalyst and that whole era of cool Southern California music. So we'll get into that. But I want to go back to something you said before. You were talking about, forgive me, I don't remember his first name, the drummer Hopkins.
Tony, yeah.
Tony Hopkins. And you said that you didn't know how to, quote-unquote, swing. And I was just curious, does swinging only come from playing live, so you just become completely secure with yourself? I mean, is there other ways to learn that stuff, or do you really just feel you got to get out there and say what you got to say?
Well, you've got to get out there and get the feeling of it, because for a jazz musician, it's not really about the notes. It's where you're putting your notes, and that's what Louis Armstrong changed forever. When you see, go to YouTube and look at him in 1933 in Paris singing Dinah, and where he's putting die. Nah, that, you know, where he's putting those notes makes the rhythm section, as he's leaning back, it makes the rhythm section just slightly give him a nudge. And there's this constant give and take in the time. The time's going straight ahead, but we bend it, you know, not like classical musicians. So classical musicians, our triplets are different. They're accented differently. We begin phrases on offbeats, and we end phrases on offbeats. We go across choruses and bar lines, if that's not getting too esoteric for everybody. But it's a way, it's what Lenny Tristano, my mentor and teacher a long time ago, said. It's a universal feeling. Something that we respond to. When a musician plays jazz like that and a listener is open to it, it's like mental dancing, you know?
It's reciprocation.
Yes, that's right. And this feeling that is generated Lenny felt was something deep and basic in all of us, that need to dance. But this is more an intellectual, not the intellect so much as what a jazz musician has to do is generate the notes from the feeling and not the other way around. The feeling creates a note,
mm-hmm.
whether it's like Charlie Parker and there are 64 of them, or Louis Armstrong with one. You know, it's all got that beautiful swinging feeling, which we owe tremendously to him.
It also strikes, like I talked to a bass player, John Hurd, who, yeah. you know, he basically was like, hey, if it's not knee patting music, if it's not shaking me up, you know, I'm not doing my job. I mean, it has to make you feel, it has to make you want to dance.
Well, you know, I'm going to make a distinction there.
Mm-hmm.
It's not dance music. It's not dance music. It's way, way more sophisticated than that. And, but the underlying feeling, you know, because dance music could be anything. I mean, it's not. It's specific to making music, but if it makes your heart and your body feel like swinging, then that you're doing the right thing, you know. Because a lot of jazz that I hear now is very technical, and it's basically downbeats, da little da little da little da little da, you know, and they play in 7/16 or whatever, you know, and little, but it's not that. Something completely different, and I can't define it other than to listen to Lester Young or somebody simpler at the beginning of this music, who's laying it down that way. And, how I learned from Tony Hopkins, he turned me on to Wynton Kelly. Wynton Kelly, ba da 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 da. It's not da 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 da. It's ba da 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 da. Those things. Though that's the feeling you have to generate from your eighth note, you know, and that's the thing that makes everybody go, oh yeah, you know.
We just got about we're going to go to a hard break here in about a little like 2 minutes, Alan. But I just wanted to ask you right now, just real quick about what you're up to right now. As far as I know, you just moved to New York, but you're playing with Charlie Hayden right now.
We have a tour in October. I have some string sweetening gigs that sustain me on a few records that I'm doing right now, and you know, I just grab what work I can get, hoping to play my jazz when I can. I've found a couple of great bass players here who've come over to the house already, and we're playing. So that's the thing I'm always afraid of. If we're not playing all the time. Is losing that feeling, you know. So I can do it with my metronome, but but with other human beings, it's give and take. You know?
Well, let me tell you, we're going to keep that feeling going, because when we come back, we're going to go through Woody Herman and your involvement with Irene Kroll and Pat Britt and the Southern California jazz scene. Something I'm really looking forward to. We're joined here by. One of the greatest pianists and arrangers of all time, Alan Broadbent. Alan, hang tight. We'll come back on the other side, okay?
Thank you.